some time to think. And the worst are full of passion without mercy. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely it's a second coming and the wrath has finally taken form. But what is this rock beast? It's our come at last. Sludge into oars, let the hell to be born. Sludge into oars, let the hell.
You're tuned to listener-supported community radio KBOO, Portland, Oregon, in the beautiful Willamette Valley.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Makes you such a threat. We choose the right to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. It's about power, power.
Get the remote. Kawan Betu Washtelo, Chante Washte Napech Yuzap Yellow Le Umkipiki He Washtelo. Greetings and good day and welcome, my relatives. I shake your hands with good feelings in my heart. It's good for all of us to be here. This is First Voices Radio. And I send you greetings and strength from the east gate of Turtle Island, where the sun and the water touch the earth at once. And I'm Teoxin Ghost Horse, and you are listening to an all-native hosted, all-native produced First Voices Radio. Now in its 29th year of broadcasting, and Liz Hill is the producer of First Voices Radio. You can hear us on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Buzzsprouts, Spotify, as well as firstvoicesindigenousradio.org for archives. And George Nuku, our guest, is an artist from Aotearoa, or commonly referred to in the modern times as New Zealand, as Aotearoa is throughout its continuance in the modern times. And he is of the Maori nation and of Scottish and German descent, and has been a full-time practitioner of arts for 35 years. And for the last 20 years of art practicing, he has spent globally, ranging from the world's prestigious art institutions and treasure houses throughout, through to communities of all ethnicities and socioeconomic statuses. George has created more than 100 projects to date, including the British Museum, the National Museum of Scotland, Museum of Geneva, Museum of Anthropology in Vancouver, British Columbia, Museum of Contemporary Art in Taiwan, United Nations Forum of Indigenous Peoples, and Tijibau Cultural Center in Naumea, New Caledonia, and many more. George carries the thousands of year-old art traditions of his ancestors that promise to both expand life and enhance survival. And in this interview, George Nuku discusses his journey, ranging from children to the elders to the ancestors, the concepts of time, practicality with earth throughout his art carvings, to the political aspects of working at the United Nations in the early 2000s. So we talk about the importance of indigenous peoples who were largely ignored by the dominant societies. And if it weren't for previous generations who didn't need the dominant societies and being noticed by Mother Earth, let alone modern day society, the Maori Nation culture is vibrant, up to date, never archaic, as many indigenous peoples' thoughts and ways of living with the earth. And in this episode, we go to George Nuku and we begin this interview, and we'll be back. This is Teoxin Ghost Horse and First Voices Radio. This is George Nuku. Just good to see you, and it's an honor to talk to you with all your travelings throughout the world. And I think the listeners would want to hear a journey of how indigenous people, I wouldn't say make it in the world, but how indigenous people bring awareness and aliveness to the rest of the world. We are so needed even today, as we were saying back in 2003, why aren't they listening to us? And if they do listen to us, are they really hearing us in a good way rather than the way they want to hear us? Let's talk about how we met back at the United Nations.
Yeah, I guess I should start by saying that coming to New York on the basis of my art practice, kind of like a flying carpet, you could say that as a person practicing art, like I'm 57 years old now, and I've been full-time practitioner for 35 years. And like you said, in those early 2000s, what was that time of my life where some doors opened for me to come to New York and present my work, and I met you, and it was a big experience for me, because I felt like I had come to a sort of an epicenter, you could say, an epicenter where there were first peoples from the top to the bottom of the Americas engaging with Uncle Sam, and being in that arena and that platform of New York as a crossroad to not only voice their respective positions, but also to meet and create solidarity, and you know, which is kind of like what family does. You see your cousins and you feel they're family. Obviously, with First Peoples, it's still real. You could say, you know, that we're related to each other. We have genealogies. We celebrate that. It's just the human component of our greater relationship with everything else, with every other thing on that, as we walk on our mother's back and our dad's above us, you know, it's like that. and how I remember those days of meeting you, and I'm this fresh-eyed guy from the colonies, man, you know, from the British Empire, you know, you know, and I have to be honest, you feel your colonization when you go to another universe. You feel how British you are. You feel the dual kind of binary thing you've got with being a Maori and being colonized by a Great Britain. You know, you feel it because that's what you are. It's like meeting you and all the other people, and it was like, but the DVD's got a different menu. You know, there's people are speaking Spanish and they're speaking with an American tonation, and on top of that, you are like the older siblings to us, and you've been through this for 500 years. We're in it for 200, so we're like you in the year 1800, you could say, in some ways, and we are still kind of half believing we're free. And for me to meet the older brothers and see what it's like to be in this for five centuries, what it does to you, eh? How you live with it, how we all are kind of at different points along the trapeze rope, you know, we're all like these trapeze artists balancing between directing the changes and being directed by the changes. And we're this kind of, you know, we're kind of walking on this trapeze, right? And balancing between being agents of the changes and being victims of the changes, and how we can reconcile the, and all of us knowing how far we've come and how much our old people, what it cost, what, you know, what it cost, how they, what they did so that we could be in that situation of seeing each other again and saying, hey man, it's good to see you again. You know, wow. What took you so long, George? And, you know, and you guys have got your own kind of special kind of way of laughing at the genocide, laughing with the genocide. You know, like the sense of humor is it's, there's so much behind it. When you guys say to someone like me, you know, and it stays in me, eh, man. You guys say things like, you know, George, I used to complain a lot until my grandmother came along and said, get off your cross, we need the wood. And now I don't complain so much. And, you know, for me, that's just like, wow, that's, you feel the psychic door of time and space and distance kind of collapsing there, you know, and meeting like that. And like I said, in New York, we were all converging, eh? You know, we were all, and then we're in that edifice, you know, of the UN, and we're being, you know, and we're being patted down by the guards and going through the security and, you know, the whole deal. And then you see all the peoples of the world with their aspirations coming with these pieces of paper in their hands, dashing around from corridor to corridor, photocopying each other's, to support each other's declarations and agendas. And it's a kind of like a revolution with photocopy machine. You know, it's a kind of a paper dreams on paper, you know. And then you're questioning, ultimately you're questioning, like, does change really happen? It's kind of surreal. You feel like you're making a difference, and then you're just looking at this big machine and going, but does it? And I mean, I'm in another category, because I got this kind of role of, I'm an artist, you know, so I'm there to like present my art. I can sort of, in the name of art, I can get away with murder, so to speak. You know, I'm the guy who makes art, you know, I'm not politician, I'm art guy, you know. And how at the same time we all remember, though, that in our worlds, the people who made the art were at the center of the wheel. And the people who make the music and the songs and the stories and the art are the people who make, they're the axis mundi, they are the pivot that turns the world. They're responsible for making sure the world turns, you know, that everything's turning. And people often say, oh, are you artists, say, you think the world revolves around you? Go, yeah, that's our job. And after the big changes, we run, you know, we are like, no longer in the hub, but we're on the rim of the wheel, pushed out to the periphery, and And the people in the center are the people wearing, you know, the bureaucrats of our tribes, the people who wear suits and ties, and all these, for me, all these dynamics are all, you know, they're all present because I'm in New York, and it's just a place where there's all these dreamers and revolutionaries of all the different colored strands of the rope, you know, this rope of humanity that we're kind of braiding together to make from these different strands of who we are. And but we all come from mum and dad, you know, we're all coming from mum and dad. And I can never ever forget you, Tilkerson, in those times, man. You know, like, can never forget, man, that you play your music and you invite me to play my music with you, and we make those you know, those harmonics, you know, those vibrations. And it's the language of nature, bro.
It's so deep. And you know, you describe a whole time that was so short, but yet it deep, and it made an impression, as you say, upon all those who participated at the United Nations back in 2003, and yet it's ongoing all this time. And you talk about change, George. And when I think about the change, what made us all to arrive at that time from our backgrounds? I started on a reservation, you can say economically poor, but culturally rich in our language, in our thoughts, coming from the earth where the earth doesn't lie, so our language doesn't lie, yet we come into a place where the deception is the language we speak now. And now you're out in the world, and you came from, what is it, the South Island or North Island of
New Zealand? North Island, in the North Island on the East Coast.
Aotearoa.
Yeah, of Aotearoa, from a village, moved from a village to a housing project in the city, a government Māori housing project, and then from there, you know, gravitated to a bigger city because I was looking for opportunities with my art, and then I grew my wings and started, you know, seeing the kind of the world as my forest, you could say.
The first Maori I met was in 93 in Hawaii, and the Kanaka Maoli, your cousins, and we shared our creation stories. And one of those creation stories was, we came from the Pleiades, that area, and we came and we met, and now we're moving that energy so that the world turns, as you say, and that's what's necessary today. And you talk about your art, yet you say it's non-political, but that moves, that energy of what you do during the art. Could you describe to the folks your art, especially because it's now worldwide and it comes from your people, the heart of the art, so to speak. The art is from the heart of the Maori people, and the carvings that we see so similar, but yet it's distinctive. And someone would say, well, that's a Nuku. That's still his style. Your time, your effort, and the way your style is put into, you know, even recycling. You're making a statement by using recycling material also. Can you talk a little bit about that art?
Yeah, okay. As I said in the beginning, I'm 57 years old now. So I was born in 1964. My parents were in the military. My mother's Māori and my father's Scottish, German Jewish and Scottish. So I'm a kind of genetic cocktail, you could say. And you know, and my parents couldn't console themselves, and they parted when I was 4 years old. This is, you know, the kind of the 60s, the 1960s, and in a country like New Zealand, Aotearoa New Zealand, back then, our designation is half caste. You know, so we're on the forms, you fill out your forms, you're half caste. And those days, being half caste and being from a solo parent, I kind of had the double stigma. This was socially unacceptable kind of person. It's a bit different now. It's not such a big deal as it was back then, I remember clearly. And so because of that stigma, I grew up with my grandmother and my senior uncles and aunts and villagers and that. So I grew up with them. So because in our custom, the grandparents or the senior people, whoever, they have the right to say, oh, I'm going to look after your child. And you do. You know, we, in that functional way, you share the children. If some people don't have kids and some people have a lot of kids, then it's, and they're related, then say, okay, you can look after some of my kids. It's not really adoption, it's something else. It's just kind of extended looking after each other anyway. And so that's the world I was in the village, right? And I have strong memories of my early days of, you know, I remember seeing people from the 19th century. You know, they were from the 19th century. They were from the 1800s. They were old and they were spooky, you know, and they were from another, literally from another world, you know. And those have lasting memories of me. And so I remember my life before globalization. You know, I'm a pre-globalization indigenous person, man. Made the transition into globalization, but I remember the time before that. I remember the time when we were fiercely Māori and like I said, and fiercely colonial at the same time. You know, that's the paradox. That's the, you know, this was before this globalization invasion wave, like a tsunami, comes on, you know, generated by the mass media of the United States and places like that, obviously. And so the world was quite, there was just us Māori and the settlers. That was it. So I come from that kind of binary existence. And then, like I said, we moved into the city. And I saw what happened with the city life and how our fabric of our traditional society started to come apart at the seams. And then we had increase of the side effects of that, eh? You know, like then we're all squashed in this place like sardines. And then we've got, alcohol abuse, drug abuse, domestic violence, and ultimately rise of urban gangs. And all of these factors, you know, and then at the same time, after the Second World War, you know, the people immediately after the Second World War born then, they had gone and got university education and stuff like that. That's the generation just before me who armed themselves with knowledge and challenged the government of the day for the rights of our language, the rights of our lands, the rights of our customs, and they became our hero. They were the people I looked up to. We looked up to them, and they were our inspiration. They guided us, and those people went actively to the old people and got as much off them before it was too late, you know, and the old people encouraged them and said, yeah, you do this, and you know what you have to do, and all of that. And so, in my generation of people born in the 60s and the 70s, we grew up and we wanted to identify who we were. So many of us chose the arts, or the arts chose us. You know, it chose us, it told us what to do. And we expressed our identity through carving and through painting and through weaving and through song and through the revival of canoe culture, of the revival of our traditional music, the revival of our language. And you know, I feel honored to be part of that participation of that. So we all had dreams, man. We all had dreams. You know, we dreamed about Māori radio. We dreamed about Māori TV. We dreamed about seeing our language on street signs and in the landscape. We dreamed about this because we were told as children in the 70s, under no certain terms, that our language had no value, that it was of no value. And you assimilate or die, assimilate or perish. That was the options. And we're like, no, we will engage, you know, we will engage, we will carry it all on our shoulders or in our arms. We will carry our entire culture on our back, in our arms, on our shoulders, and we will never let it fall on the ground, and we will never turn our back on it. And That's how I feel about my art practice, that I have never turned my back on those things that I have been handed from our ancestors, you know? And I have never put it on the ground in the dust, and I've never turned my back on it, and it's looked after me. It's looked after me through, and it's taken me to meet you and so many people. In time, I started to say to myself, well, you know, it spoke to me as well, and I said, look, you're not a photocopy machine, George. You're going to have to show the gods and the ancestors something they haven't seen before. And so I started making the ancestors and the gods out of plexiglass and plastic bottles and styrofoam and challenging tradition. But in doing that, I say I'm an intensely traditional person. You know, I'm because what I'm saying is that I want to take the old and make the old new, like make the old and the new eyes of today, so that it's old but it's new at the same time. That's what it tells me to do, not to be afraid to be like that and to just dare to be it and have this grounding and this background of them before us, but at the same time, wanting to take it into across new oceans and new voyages, you know? And somebody like me, you reach the stage where you think that you must share these gifts. You must share them with everybody, man. You gotta, it's funny, you almost see everybody as equal. It does that to you. It makes you feel like everybody on this earth is equal. And that, especially the young people, more than anything, they're the number one, you know, that, and they're all equal and you want to give it to them all equally. You know, I'm sort of like that. I'm like that now. And it causes tension because to some people, you can be seen as kind of committing cultural treason in your willingness to give it. And they say, oh, George, you shouldn't give it all away to them, to account, plus the desire to want to share because ultimately, Tjokasin, to put it simply, bro, I see what people like yourself and myself and all the people we know, all the ones we meet in New York, what's behind all that intention. You know, we're trying to restore confidence, the restoration of confidence that's been damaged, huh? You know, that we've been humiliated and we've been taught the systematic centuries of it, of creating the self-loathing, the self-hatred and the self-loathing and this low self-esteem and all the horrendous side effects that causes, huh? And how we turn on each other in this perverse power thing and we hurt each other, you know? And how, okay, so we want to restore our confidence. And then I've discovered that's only half of it, man. That's only half of it. The restoration of confidence is only half of it. The other half is we got to build empathy. You know, we got to build empathy so that we can see through the eyes of the other and the other can see through the eyes of us. And that's what propels me in this life and my art is to contribute to this building of empathy because I feel that it's so not present anymore. Daily, it's becoming less and less present and the consequences are horrendous. You know, how people are to each other and how people treat each other and it's like you got to go inside somebody else's skin or as the Pākehā say, be in my shoes or whatever metaphor is deployed to say that thing of empathy of like you can't walk past somebody who's got nothing and just carry on walking. You can't eat your sandwich in front of somebody who's hungry. You just can't. You know, it's an insult to our mother. It's an insult because she gives us everything without conditioner. You know, she don't give us a 65% sunrise. You know, she gives to everybody, even Mr. Trump gets it all equally, man. She's like this unconditional mother, you know, gives her love to us unconditionally. And we all know that feeling when we do something for our mother, we know what it does to our mother. You do something for your mum and, oh, mama, I just done this for you. And you remember those times when mum just glows and she's so, so happy. And well, it's the same for out here, right? Our mother, you know, like, I found my place in the world to contribute to this building of empathy.
And that's George Nuku, who's an artist from Aotearoa Maori Nation, and he's coming at you on the station, and you are listening to First Voices Radio. Back to George Nuku.
It's totally something to say that through it all, whatever came out of our struggles, your struggles in this case, George Nuku is one Maori living in one world. And that one world is how you say Mother Earth sees us. And when I'm thinking about how you say half caste or is like the same here in the States and in Canada, where it's a degree of blood. How much are you this? And to let go of that, we need to split ourselves up and to measure ourselves in order to be qualified for something. And I think it goes both ways. The more full blood you are, they're trying to protect that. Yet those who have a little blood, they're trying to say that they know about everything. But when you walk that world where you see that from the Earth's perspective, how she really cares for us unconditionally, like you say.
Yeah.
You know, that's the seed of who we are. The empathy for the earth is the seed of our indigeneity. And through our mistakes, as we know, we make a lot of mistakes when we have to live in that world. We grew up one way, now we live in this other world, and yet we see which one would benefit the earth. I often call people who take too much, those who take the cake and eat it too.
Right.
We have a word called washichu that means takes too much. And that's what's making people starve in another place. Or maybe it's also a lack of knowledge of how to live with the earth. When my uncle would say, there's a way to live with earth and a way not to live with earth. And we choose the way of earth. And I think that defines our consciousness or intelligence, because it comes from the bones of the earth, the elements, the water, the fire, the earth, you know, the birds, the plants. That's our intelligence. When I see that, that's what I'm seeing in a true quote unquote indigenous person, which is a colonial word, meaning the poor people over there. Indigent genus, the poor race. That's all it means. So when people claim that, I often wonder if they really know the language that they're speaking, because I'm hearing that you understand the language and therefore you can understand how to translate that spirit that's true to the Maori people.
Yeah, well, I do say this, you know, I work with young people all around the world in my art projects, right? And I say to them, look, if you're going to take anything in this world, the one thing you have to take, and you take it with both hands, you take it, you grasp it, and that is, you take the care, you take that care with your two hands, you grab it and you hold on to the care and you take it, and you take it with all yourself when you take the care, right? And that makes you a caretaker. You know, you are taking the care. You take care of each other. You take care of all the people in your classroom. You take care of the others. And you take care of that business, and you take care of everything you do. And coupled with that, if we're gonna pay for anything in this world, you pay the attention. And you pay it in full. You pay full attention. That's what the old people say to us. You know that, Tjokosin. They drill us, man. They say, pay attention. Pay attention. Open your eyes. Open your ears. Pay full attention. You'll learn so much, you know? And take care of everything you do in this journey, this life. Take care of the details, you know? Take care of what you're thinking. Take care of what you're saying. You might have to eat those words. They better be sweet when you eat them, man.
Right, that's right.
Yeah, and those are just like things that people seem to have. Maybe you could say a kind of a temporary amnesia, you know? And that the Maori way of looking at things, you know, like I told you, man, I'm a half caste. There's many terms to describe me, right? Metis, mulatto, half caste, half breed, hybrid, mutant, all of these things, right? You know, so I've even got two conceptions of time and space, man. On my German Scottish side, there's a conception that time is linear, and I'm walking into the future on this line, and the past is behind me. And then on my Maori side, my Maori universe tells me, no, George, you're walking in a spiral and you're walking backwards. So you're walking backwards, so the future's behind you. As you're walking backwards into the future, it's behind you. And as you're walking backwards with the future behind you, the past is directly in front of you. You're facing the past, walking backwards into the future, and as you do that, the past is unfolding in front of your very eyes to form your present reality. So that means if the future's behind me, then the future's something, it's a memory because it's behind me. the future is based on remembering, that we can remember the future. And if we can remember the future, remember, that means it's just a case of, we already know. It's just like rethinking your library card, re-updating your library. You know, you're already a member. You're just to bring it up to date, you know. We're just, and when I met you and we meet people from those origin place, origin worlds, cultures, right? We know this because our genes and our DNA vibrate to each other. You know, we remember each other, man. We remember, it's like, wow, I haven't seen you for ages. Wow, it's good to see you again. And everybody feels that, don't they? They feel like they've known someone before. We evoke memories. We must well admit it, all of us men, that we're all lost trying to get home. We're all lost and we're all trying to get home. And let's look at the trees and the plants, for example. They're showing us the way. When they grow away, they're returning to the source, man. They're returning home. We don't really say, I'm going home. We say, I'm returning home. And the plants give us the best example, because they return to our first creation memory. It's built into them, like it's built into all of us. Our first creation memory was when we can remember we were the light of stars. That our first creation memory that's encoded in us all, that we are the light of stars. And so we're just going home. All of us, we're returning home. It's whether we're a fish or a, you know, or a plant or a human being or a mammal, whatever. We all come from that first creation memory. And I work with these young people and I say to them, look, man, we talk about plastic, right? We talk about plastic and I say, God, where does the plastic come from? And they go, oh, I don't know, hang on. It comes from petroleum, eh? Yeah, petroleum. Yeah. Where does that come from? Hang on, we talk about it. It comes from the oil. Where does oil come from? And they scratch their head and go, come on, work it out. Oh, it comes from deep down in the ground, deep inside mum. That's right. Comes deep in the ground. Oil comes up. How? What's oil from? What makes oil? We work it out, eh? Oh, it comes from the bones of all the dinosaurs and the very first forests and millions of years of layers of time and pressure and creating this oil. So yeah, that's right. So all of that makes that plastic bottle in our hand, right? We go, yeah. So that means this plastic bottle's millions of years old. Yeah. And they go, yes, it's millions and millions of years old. Older than us, eh? Yeah. So in a way, this plastic bottle's like our ancestor, right? You know, it's like our elder. And they go, yeah. They go with me on that. Yes, like our elder. So we need to treat our elders with more respect, don't we? So this plastic bottle that we hold every day is probably the oldest thing you could ever hold in your, you know, it's so old, right? And they go, yeah, it's the oldest thing. And I say, yeah. But at the same time, it's the newest thing. So it's both the oldest thing and the newest thing in the one breath, in the one heartbeat. And they get that. They go, yeah, okay, yeah. And I go, and that's the same as you young people. I say to them, you're older than me. You're older, man. You're you and all of the ones before you. That makes you older than me. But you're newer than me as well. So you're just like that plastic bottle. You're the oldest and the newest, and you're that plastic bottle is so a reflection of you. It's shiny, you know, it's bling, it's transparent, it's translucent, it's so modern and it's so ancient like them. And everywhere I go in this world to do my projects, those are two things I see, bro. Plastic bottles everywhere and young people everywhere. These things come to me because the plastic tells me to say these things. The plastic says to me, George, help to do your part, George, so they can see the plastic bottle. And I mean, it would be, if I could just like pluck my eyes out of my head, take my eyes out and put them in people's eyes, then they would see what I see with the plastic. But I, you know, I do that with my art so we can get closer to this thing. We can get closer to it, eh, you know, because at this moment we deny it. We deny this situation, man. We deny it. And then with this denial comes indifference. we're indifferent to it. So we go, oh, it's too big for me to do anything about, or oh, it's not my problem, or, you know, someone else's job. And we become indifferent, and we come in and then we become used to being indifferent. And then we can be indifferent to everything and anything, of all things that, oh, it's nothing to do with me, and I'm just going to carry on my convenient world, you know? And that is one of the things that I see in front of me, is this indifference, and how like we were talking earlier about empathy, and how, so I take this plastic bottle and I say to kids, like, you know, how does this plastic bottle get in the ocean? And they're like, they look at me and I go, does the plastic bottle throw itself in the ocean? No, of course not. How does it get in there? Humans put it in the ocean. Yeah? Yep. How do we stop humans from putting it in the ocean? And I say, look, one way, if we turned around and said, this plastic bottle's worth $10,000, ho! We'd be hanging on to it. We wouldn't let it go. We'd be hanging on to it. We'd be like taking good care of it and making sure it's safe and, you know, thinking about it and all that, and paying people to protect it and blah, 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 and all this. Because we know that money is a dominant source, measurement of value in our world. So I'm saying, okay, but it's not the only value. It's not the only way to measure value. So we take this thing that is nobody wants to look at, the pollution, the trash, and you create intense beauty from it with your imagination, with your potential. We can create intense beauty. And so it goes from the thing that nobody wants to look at to the thing they can't take their eyes off, bro. Like a Ferrari, like a diamond ring, like a beautiful man or woman, because beauty is a universal thing, right? And beauty's everywhere. There's beauty in everything. You can see it if you just open your eyes. And so we can do this thing where we can turn it around. So I start saying that it's a treasure, bro. I start saying, let's look at it like a treasure. Let's look at it like a discovery. Let's look at it like discovering and treasure, and because hating on it, being denying it, abhorring it, being indifferent to it, it's not working. It's not working. It's not working.
You hit on a very key energy there, where I'm seeing this as the earth is treating us equal, as you say. It shines on everybody. And so where is the language? In my language, a Lakota language, there is no word for domination. Because if we have domination, then we cannot communicate with all life forms, because those life forms are equal to us. But when we are over them, we're talking down at them or up at it, right? Mm. So in these languages, when I'm traveling the world, I'm finding a lot of indigenous people's languages are similar without domination. So we can't think hierarchically. We can only think like, you know, a son or a daughter is no longer a son or a daughter. It's your younger brother and younger sister. And so therefore you have to teach them, treat them, show them like the earth shows us, because we can never teach earth lessons. Earth is always teaching us lessons. So in a way to go out with this in a couple more minutes, George, is the language of Maori. You spoke about it earlier, how important that is, and will be in order for us to see the world as you do in the relationship and inequality with all life, and even seeing something so negative in one way, the binary system, but yet seeing it as something we can change the energy of it and use it properly. You see where I'm going with that?
Well, I know in the Maori culture, we got many stories. We got stories of what people did to create changes, of what people did, and how by their actions, what the things that they did to go and get certain things and make our life into what it was then, tells me that even from the very first moments, we were always redefining ourselves, even before the colonization and all that, even before that, and you could almost say that the redefinitions are almost like, you could say they're a daily occurrence, man. We are constantly redefining ourselves, and we have to own that. You know, we can't be seen to be less for that, or making or or making ourselves feel less, or look, or judging the other as less for that, that we're always going to be redefining our way of life. You know, I take that approach, and I say to people, you know, with all due respect, I say, hey guys, don't worry, it'll be traditional by this afternoon. And I got enemies for saying that, and I accept that. And so I say to myself, well, George, nobody said this was a popularity contest, brother, you know. And if you're brave enough to wear your heart on the outside, as we say, kia mano anui, or in Francais, in French, they say courage. You know, I love this word in French, you know, courage, courage, cour, heart, courage. Having the what it takes to take your heart and wear it on the outside, and how this bravery can be in some ways give other people the auto permission to do to be brave as well. And like Nelson Mandela said, it's the thing that people fear the most is not the darkness, it's the light. It's the light, man. You know, that when you stand in the light, you can't just present only parts of yourself. All is revealed, right? The people see all, in the community, they see all, even when you're trying it on. They see it all, especially the old ladies. They're the best at it, you know? And the aunties and the grannies, they're like, you can't get it past them, man. And by standing in that light, you know, you risk all, but you give other, by what seems to create an auto permission with others to do the same, to step out of the shadows and take your place in the light, side by side.
In closing here, there's this thing that you know, we've said a lot here from the States because of the way we look, peace with Earth. We have accorded our language to find peace with Earth because humans have not found peace on Earth amongst each other. So the more we find peace with Earth, the more we will be able to have peace amongst humans and other life forms, because we are speaking a language that's at war against the Earth, because we're taking, we're not giving. So when we speak in abundance, like you are, I'm feeling the abundance that's coming from your Maori, your core, your heart, you say, you know. And just a closing thought for our peoples, because we're going to talk more in the future.
I think we were talking about these, you know, these crazy people, right? You know, these dreamers, man. You know, these people that make things from the imagination, they from the inner, and they bring it onto the outer, whether it's a song or music or art or a blank, a woven thing, or all these things that this creativity that people do. You know, like for people to do that, they have to trust themselves. They have to trust themselves first, right? To overcome the shyness or the whatever it is to. But they know they got to do it. They can't imagine not doing it. You know, it's just so strong, that this desire to want to get it out of what it is that they need to, you know. And we all have that. And how it you do it long enough, like you and me, and you end up having this relationship with yourself that you trust yourself. And so if you can do that, then you're trustworthy. You can be trusted, you know, and trust is what's missing. You know, we don't trust our neighbors, we don't trust the government, we don't trust the police, we don't trust each other. And this trust needs to, growing this trust, taking these people who are crazy enough to make the world turn, who, you know, who work for mum and dad, who work for, you know, the CEO is mum and dad and heaven and earth. Because when we talk about this turning thing, don't forget that in the storm, in this seemingly chaotic storm, the eye of it is calm. And we all know that when we do what we do, and it seems chaotic, but inside we're calm, because we're doing what we know we're supposed to be doing. And it produces no matter how difficult it is, it produces a calmness, and it produces its own stillness inside you, because you know you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, helping the people, working with the people, helping our world, doing your bit, being true. It doesn't matter how hard it is. That's not coming into it anymore, how easy it is or how hard it is, or inside you find peace, huh? By doing those things. People say, oh, how do we go and find peace in ourselves? George said, easy. Go and help people, man. It'll kind of get things moving. Trust me. You know, just go and do some stuff for other people without credit, without, just go and do it, man. And you'll be surprised what comes back. You just don't know. The thing about these gifts is that we talk about, you know, they come from our mother and our father. They are the things that can't be regulated, man. They can't be commodified. They can't be legislated. They can't. You can't predict what you're going to imagine tomorrow. That is what's so scary and dangerous in a good way, but at the same time so exciting about us as people, this potential, that we have this potential because the sky's the limit and there's no limit, you know, providing your heart is good, providing you know it's, if it is or not, you better know. You can unleash this beautiful potential and it makes a difference on the leaves and everything, man. It makes a difference straight away. Those leaves more shiny. Like you said, that's real wealth. I tell you, man, everybody out there, this globalization, I call it this globalization of mediocrity in the name of money. And it's resulting in two things, the retardation of thinking and a poverty of spirit. That's what's happening. We got to like take the cue from our mother who gives us one constant extraordinary moments. Every time we look at the sky, it's a one-off moment. It'll never be the same again. And then here comes another one-off moment. And it's been like that since day one. So the idea that we could be extraordinary, that's just ordinary with a bit of extra in the front. And then we could artfully and seamlessly join all these extraordinary moments together. And if we do that, then fear and doubt's got no place in the room. Fear and doubt's got no, it's got no corner to hide in, man. It has to flee. There's nowhere for it to stick on us. You know, that's all I'm saying, brother.
That's it. You know, just to know that what you're doing and what I'm doing here, I'm feeling you're honoring the earth through your art, through your words, and just living that mystery.
Kia ora.
And that was George Nuku, who is an artist from Aotearoa of the Maori Nation. I hope you got something out of it. I did. There are various Indigenous peoples throughout the world, and this is part of First Voices Radio's, is to bring all the voices of all the continents on Mother Earth. Thank you for joining us. My name is Teokasin Ghost Horse. Give care. Yeah.
Portland, full strength community radio. This is Kabaka Pyramid representing from Kingston, Jamaica. Baby Rock family, you don't know.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.